Judiciary Committee is called to order. Members, take your seats. A quorum is present. Members, we have bills on the calendar today. House File 932, Mahler, 724, Cantrell, 1140, Lesh, that's the gestational carrier contracts, 1050, Moran, child foster care, 2379, Brand, policy provisions, direct care and treatment, and 2397, Representative Pryor, human services, modifying policy provisions governing children and family services. So the first order of business is the minutes, right? Approval of minutes of March 12th. Do I have a motion? Representative Cantrell moves the minutes of March 12th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of March 12th are approved. First bill on the calendar, Representative Mahler, House File 932, emergency contacts disclosure on driver's license. If there's anyone else who's here to, who in the audience is here to testify on House File 932? Raise your hand. Up real high. Okay. Wow. Well, okay. If you're flying solo. The motion on this bill, members, is that it be re-referred to Ways and Means. Members, just so you know, we are going to be going by at a clip. We have these nine bills on the calendar, I don't know how many it is, but we don't have a room tonight, which means whatever we don't finish, we spill over into tomorrow morning and then tomorrow night. We'll just leave it at that for now. So we are going to be moving this along. Representative Mahler moves that House File 932 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. To your bill, Representative Mahler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 932 really is an idea that came from a constituent of mine. His name is Mitchell Raggi, and unfortunately he couldn't be here today because of an appointment. I think a lot of you have had the opportunity to meet with Mitchell. Mitchell was in a car crash and had a serious damage as a result, and his parents were unable. He was in his 20s, and he had his own address at the time. And when he had the crash, nobody knew who to contact to let them know about this crash. And it took about over 8 hours for law enforcement and first responders to figure out who his family was to notify. And he was in a life or death situation. Mitchell got a severe brain injury as a result of the crash, has been working with the Brain Injury Alliance, and came up with, I think, a really common sense idea, which is when you apply for a driver's license, that you have the option of giving three contact information, emergency contact information, so that in the event of an emergency, first responders will know who to contact. And so, like I said, he's not here to testify. The portion of the bill that's really relevant to this committee is the data practices provision on line 2.27. The emergency contact is classified as private data under 13.02 subdivision 12. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd stand for questions from the committee.
Thank you, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mueller. So in regards to MNLARS, I just have a huge concern because they're still rolling this out. We've heard about all the problems with this. This would obviously add an extra field or maybe even three fields. Do you have any have you worked with them, or does the department have any opinions
on
programming?
Yeah, I don't know if they're here today. They were here at the last hearing. Yeah, come on forward. And it's my understanding that they would be able to add those fields to it. This bill does have a fiscal note for that. I don't know if you have any specific questions about their ability to do that.
But Sarah, do you have a specific question for the testifier?
Well, just what impact that might have on the ongoing effort for MNLARS. But then my second part before I was cut off there was, in regards to making this private, is the other information on the driver's license currently considered private, or would this be separate from the categorization of data on the license now?
Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, so the information of the emergency contacts isn't actually going on the driver's license. It will be maintained in a database that law enforcement can get that information in the event of emergency. So it's not going on the actual driver's license itself.
Representative Lucero.
So then for the categorization of that information, so it would be retained in the database, but the existing data that's in the database, first, middle, last name, DOB, is that current information of the same category that this is you're seeking to do with this information?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what that categorization is of the current information on there. I don't know if.
Okay, do you want to introduce yourself for the record and answer?
Carrie Briones, I'm the legislative analyst for DBS. Mr. Lucero, to your question on categorization, I will double-check with our data practices guru because I do not want to misspeak on that. She wasn't able to be here, but I would like to clarify that the changes here will be in the FAST-DS system and not in MNLARS.
Representative Lucero,
okay, thank you. So then, not our question, just a comment. So if it is a separate categorization of the existing information within the system, then there would have to be a private data, and that would have data to be set. Protected separately from the existing data.
Yes, so there would have to be a creation of a data set, which I don't know if this bill does or not, but I don't know. I guess we'll find out, won't we? Representative Johnson.
Chair Marriott, this can be a long day.
Well, if you keep talking, it will be. Go ahead, Chair Johnson. I'm sorry.
Representative, I want to thank you for this bill. This is a good bill. I've been in the unfortunate situation going to a very severe or fatal car crashes with people that do not live in the community I worked, and trying to find people to notify, especially when there's young children involved. It's very difficult. I was at one incident where it took us 14 hours to notify the parents of what happened to their young child. It's very disturbing to law enforcement, and it's very disturbing to the people involved. And having a way to get in contact with these people and getting the help that they need, and also with their children, getting the help they need at the hospitals or even doing the unfortunate notifications, having that information be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Mueller, for bringing this really common sense bill. I did meet with the advocates, I think it was yesterday, and I did have some concerns that the persons who would be the contacted individuals, the emergency contacted individuals, would probably want to, there should be some way of verifying that they're okay with having their name entered into this database, and I expressed to the advocates, and I'm more than happy to work with you and them to make this thing work, because I think it's a really practical thing to do. So thank you.
That's a good point, Chair Scott. That would be creepy to put like an ex-girlfriend on there that you've been broken up with for like 4 years and she gets a call. Representative Mueller, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Scott, and I appreciate that and would be happy to work with those changes on you. It's my understanding that they're being worked on in the Senate already. Yeah.
Okay, seeing no other questions, then Chair Mueller's motion is that House File 932 be referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Next bill is House File 742, Representative Cantrell. Members, we've already had a full hearing on this, and so we're not going to be taking any other testimony or really not any really discussion either. We're just moving it to the floor. We need to incorporate the amendments. Okay, so Representative Cantrell, you move that House File 724 be recommended to be placed on the general register. You have an author's amendment. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have an author's amendment, and this differs from my first delete all just because it incorporates the language that we end up deciding on for the overall amendment at the end of the last hearing.
Okay. Any other questions, discussion on this? Seeing none, then all in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Anything else you want to say on the bill, Representative Cantrell?
No, Mr. Chair, members. I think that that this bill will go a long way to help a lot of families in Minnesota. So I appreciate the committee's help on this and your time.
Thank you. Representative Cantrell moves that House File 724 as amended be referred to place on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, you know, here's the one thing. So, Chair Moran, how long is your bill going to take?
Very short.
Hey.
Good answer.
We'll see. Okay, why don't you come up here? We'll do you first because you're waiting here. I'd like to. Representative Moran is a chair of HHS and is very busy, and so
yes.
I'd like to get her out of here as soon as
possible. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Absolutely. So on House File 1050, the motion, what's the motion, Rachel? Okay, our motion is to that the matter be referred to HHS policy. Ways and Means. We're going to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Okay, the chair moves that House File 1050 be referred to Ways and Means. Do you have any amendments?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I have an A3 amendment.
A3, I see it. Okay, does everyone have a copy of the A3? Okay. To get the bill in the shape the author so desires, all in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Did you have another amendment, that A4? Is that yours?
That's not mine. I have no idea.
Okay. Whose amendment is the A4? We'll find out later when they figure out it's their amendment, and we'll talk about it then.
Yeah. All right.
Why don't you go ahead to the bill as amended? We'll figure out the A4 later.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Chair Moran.
Mr. Chair and members, the main purpose of this bill is to bring Minnesota foster care licensing standards more in line with our adoption standards. Under current law, our foster care licensing standards and processes create many more barriers for individuals, including relatives, than our adoption standards. This inconsistency creates problems for placing children in permanent safe homes, and isn't good for family preservation. This bill also brings Minnesota in line with current federal policies and recommendations relating to foster care licensing and background checks. It is time for Minnesota to rethink and reimagine the way we license foster care providers. Unlike other providers requiring a DHS license, family foster homes are not a business. They should be a safe haven for children who can't live at home. Placing children with relatives seeking a foster care license should be an easy and quick process. Our current law has many unnecessary criminal barriers to attaining a license and a lengthy process for appealing a denial. And this is impacting relatives and others' ability to safely provide children a home when they cannot remain with their parents. For communities of color, the statutory barriers in our current foster care licensing statutes have a greater impact. This law would help remedy that disparity. When children can remain with relatives in foster care and stay connected to their families, they have better long-term outcomes, including higher high school graduation rates, decreased risk of mental health disorder, and less overall trauma. I ask Mr. Chair of your committee to support House File 1050.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Chair Moran, did you testify and want to be heard of this?
Yes.
Go ahead. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning. Nice to see you. My name is Joanna Woolman, and I'm a professor and the director of the Institute for Children, Families, and Communities at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law.
So, Professor Woolman, I got a question. When I was at Hamlin Law School, we had a mascot. It was the Pipers. Okay. Now that it's merged and everything's blended together, do you even have a mascot anymore?
I don't think we do. I think this is, and we need one.
That's a tragedy.
Yes.
Well, it's too bad. I'm sorry. Huh? No. Go ahead. It'd probably be like a little, like chasing an ambulance or something, like with a briefcase, probably. I'm sorry.
We do have the Wheels of Justice, so we
okay.
can break that in.
All right. Sorry, I'm sorry, Professor Woolman. Go ahead, please.
I'm so happy to be here today to support this bill. I don't have a lot to add to what Representative Moran said. This bill has been created over the course of 6 months with a broad-based constituency group interested in doing what's right for Minnesota's children. This is a nonpartisan issue. This is bringing Minnesota in line in terms of adoption and foster care standards and also bringing us closer to what the federal government recommends. The amendment today reflects lengthy discussions with the County Attorney's Association, and so we have added some language so that I believe they will now be in support of the bill. Happy to answer any questions this morning.
Thank you. Any questions for Professor Woolman? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One concern that I have is that, let's say someone was accused of or found guilty of cooking meth in the presence of a child. That's a 5-year sentence. And so this bill says it has a 5-year date by which you go back, right? And so to me, what you're allowing possibly to do here, unless I'm missing something, is let's say they serve that five-year term and then they get out. Does that mean they're automatically qualified then to be a foster parent again after they've just served their time?
So that's a good question. Thank you. No, certainly not. The way that the bill is written right now, that would automatically, that conviction would automatically disqualify them for 5 years. And after that five-year period, discretion with whether or not to give that individual a foster care license would remain with the agency and the DHS. And so this bill provides giving all relevant information about that individual. DHS would be required to do that to the county who was making a decision about a license recommendation. So they would receive a list of a whole bunch of things, which is background information, prior convictions, prior maltreatment determinations, and that information certainly could be used to find that that person was not an appropriate candidate for a license. So it would mean that they wouldn't be automatically disqualified after 5 years, but certainly that information would still be given, would be considered, and would be a basis to make a recommendation for the denial of a license. And certainly if there were concerns about safety of the child or concerns about continued chemical dependency use, all of that information would be considered. So the way the statute is right now, we've just got all of these crimes that get to an automatic no from the get-go. And that puts the onus on someone seeking a foster care license to go through the process of asking for reconsideration, for a variance, for a set-aside. This would sort of switch the onus onto the counties and DHS to say no. So you would get an initial, they would be eligible for a license in less, and then all of this information would be given to consider. Counties would certainly still be able to say no in that case. It wouldn't be an automatic disqualifier. It certainly could be a basis for disqualification if it were appropriate.
Okay.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Chair Moran or the testifier? Seeing none, then the chair renews a motion that House File 1050 as amended. Oh, it's yours. Okay. Okay, so are you Chair Moran, are you familiar with the A4 amendment? Do you know what it does? Or someone from DHS came with me had okay. So you want to speak to it, or okay, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Lesh. To answer your earlier question, it's the fighting eel pout.
Oh, eel pout! Oh, delicious! Thank you.
My name is Britt Kringle, K-R-I-N-G-L-E. I represent the Benefit Recovery Section at the Department of Human Services. This amendment seeks to allow the Department of Human Services to match accident data with the Department of Public Safety in order to identify Medicaid recipients, medical assistance recipients who have been involved in an accident where there may be another payer who should be paying the medical bills. We had tried the data match without Social Security information, and the information was not reliable or accurate. And so this amendment seeks to allow us to access the last four digits of the Social Security number in order to obtain more reliable matches.
Okay, so this is not a friendly amendment. Do you oppose this or support this, Chair Moran?
I don't quite understand how it relates to the other parts of the bill.
So I don't really get it.
I don't get it neither.
Maybe what we could do is, this is going to Ways and Means. Maybe when we get a little bit more time in Ways and Means to have the author understand it a little more, maybe we should just take it as a friendly amendment then. I know it's deadline week, so things are really tough. So that, can we do that? I just like people to wrap my head around it, because I'm not a dummy and I don't get it. Representative Barr.
I don't know if this is relevant or not, but the amendment is section 13.69, and the whole bill here is 245.05. So, I mean, this is way off in chapter status. I mean, they're way apart here. This amendment does not amend anything in here. It's kind of like they're trying to use anything to get this matched on, if that's me, if I'm speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, that makes sense to me.
So, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Chair Moran.
I agree with.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I mean, we don't have germaneness rules in committee.
So why don't we not take it right now and continue to work with the department to figure out how this relates to the bill?
That'd be helpful. I realize it's deadline week, so everything's scrambling, so sometimes we don't get things in ahead of time. But, yeah, let's just, if we could just hold off now and talk about it in Ways and Means to deal with thereafter. Okay, thank you. I appreciate the department coming in. Okay, so Chair renews his motion that House File 1050, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. House File 1050 as amended is referred to Ways and Means. Okay, so we're going to be doing 1140 now, which means I should get up there.
Yeah.
Oh. Thank you.
All right, the next bill that we have up is House File 1140. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. And the referral is to where?
The General Register.
Okay.
So Chair Lesh moves that House File 1140 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. So we have the bill before us. Please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Surrogacy is a complicated topic, and it's rife with, I guess, moral conversations as well. But due to that, it's also in desperate need of regulation because Minnesota currently has no regulation on it whatsoever. This bill contains many consensus items from the Legislative Surrogacy Commission that was formed a few years ago. It also puts reasonable guidelines around surrogacy to protect everyone involved, surrogates, intended parents, and children. And I would note, members, that folks on both sides of this debate, I think, generally agree that we need some regulation on this. It's the devil is in the details as far as those folks are concerned. For some folks that are pro-life, it's a selective reduction component that is inherent in the science of it. For other people, they object to whether or not someone should be compensated for doing this. And I'm not here to, debate those points with the opposition on that. But I do believe that this bill is the best result of conversations that have been had. The nationwide trend overwhelmingly favors compensation. Since 1995, 17 states have addressed surrogacy through their legislatures or courts, and 16 of them allowed and affirmed compensated surrogacy, and other jurisdictions are on the verge of joining them. If a cap on compensation is mentioned, zero states have one of those. So the compensation repays the surrogates for their time, discomfort, health risks, missed work, and sacrifices made to ensure healthy babies. And if you are one of those thousands of couples who are unable to conceive the old-fashioned way, you certainly want whoever is bearing your child to be extremely careful, to eat everything right, to do just what you would do, and that requires compensation for that lifestyle change. When medical professionals and others are getting paid for their services related to surrogacy, there's no reason why we'd single out the person who has by far the hardest and the riskiest job, and to say she isn't worthy of reasonable compensation, I guess, leaves a question in my mind. I would also note that I've met many of these women who provide this valuable service for these families who are in desperate need of children. And they're all highly educated. Heck of a lot of them are more educated than I am, and they do a great job. And I think that the specter of what could happen is not happening in Minnesota, and so I don't think we need to put those guardrails in place until we see some abuse of the system, which is why I think it's important to have the bill in this form. So with that, that's just simply my introduction, Madam Chair, and do we have the an amendment? No, this is from the last. That's not mine.
So, Mr. Chair, I think we have a number of testifiers, and what I think we should do is have all the testifiers for and against go first, and we'll do questions. And I know all the testifiers have been told to keep it to 2 minutes, and we will be keeping track of time. So I'm sorry in advance if I have to cut you off, but that's how we're going to work the committee today.
Okay.
All right. So go ahead and introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Julie Berman. I am a Minnesota resident, and I'm a member of the board of Resolve, the National Infertility Association. Resolve was formed 45 years ago when women facing infertility gathered around our founder's kitchen table to offer each other support and information. Today, Resolve provides free support groups across the country and serves as a resource for people struggling with infertility. Unfortunately, infertility is a very common disease that affects 1 in 8 couples. And it is far more than just a medical condition. It is emotionally draining, it can be financially draining, and it can cause serious stress in relationships. There are many potential causes, underlying causes of infertility, and there are many potential resolutions. One of those options is gestational carrier surrogacy, which is when a woman carries a pregnancy for another couple called the intended parents. The surrogate has no genetic link to the pregnancy. There are a number of reasons why intended parents turn to surrogacy, including heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and hysterectomies. That's why people turn to surrogacy. Resolve is proud to support Representative Lush's bill, which will provide common sense guidelines to protect everyone involved in surrogacy situations, intended parents, gestational carriers, and the children. Surrogacy, as Representative Lesh mentioned, is currently unregulated in Minnesota, and it will remain that way if this bill doesn't pass. We believe it would be much better for everyone if the guidelines and protections in this legislation become law. I urge you to support this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we've got Stephanie and Zach Weiss, maybe up next. Come on up, please. Weiss, okay. Welcome. Go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee, and you can begin. We can grab another chair, too. Are you okay? Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I'm Stephanie Weiss. This is my husband, Zach Weiss. We're intended parents. We're sorry, I'm going to try to get through this book. We're from Maple Grove, Minnesota. We've been together for 15 years, married for 10, or known each other for 10 years, and together for married for 5 years. We started trying for a baby right after we got married. We wanted so badly to have a mini version of our own. Unfortunately, after 5 years of IVF, two IVF retrieval surgeries, 6 transfers, 4 early losses, we had to resort to gestational surrogacy. I'm sorry.
Don't be. It's fine.
Yeah. We did our research, and we just started to go to gestational surrogacy. We signed up with an agency, and within 6 months, we obtained a surrogate. My husband asked this, I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
We were matched within 6 months, and the first time we talked with her on the phone, we knew that she was going to be the end of her story and the start of her bringing home a baby. That was almost a year ago, and now we're 26 weeks pregnant with our baby boy, Beckett Zachary Weiss. The joy we felt over the past 26 weeks makes us up for all the pain and struggle we went through over the last 5 years. Being able to wake up every day knowing that our baby is on his way, you can't even put into words. Surrogacy did that for us, and we always advocate for this amazing blessing of an opportunity we're given. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. What's the due date?
June 16th,
Father's Day.
Oh, fitting. Great. All right. Thank you so much for being here. Let's see. We have Corinne Voller. Great. Come on forward. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Hi. My name is Corinne Voller. I have a master's degree in marriage and... Is that crazy loud? Sorry.
No.
I have a master's degree in marriage and family therapy and work as a mental health counselor. I am married, we have 2 children and a dog, and we own our house. And I'm also a surrogate. When I was in college, my cousin was diagnosed with an aggressive form of ovarian cancer. I'm sorry, as soon as somebody starts crying, then I start crying. So This took away her ability to have children at just 22 years old. It was then that I learned she had options, and I discovered the world of infertility treatment at my cousin's side. As soon as I learned I could volunteer to be a surrogate for others, it felt like a missing puzzle piece slid into place in my heart. My cousin has decided not to have children yet, but after my own children were born, the passion to help others become parents burned even brighter, and I signed up to meet couples like them who might need help. The process to become a surrogate is neither quick nor easy. You get educated about the process, the moral issues involved, and the risks, requirements, and responsibilities. Then there are medical exams, paperwork, psychological assessments, and more. Honestly, the amount of upfront work you need to do to prove you are fit and capable can be quite daunting. Along the entire way, each professional reminds you that you don't need to do this, it's completely voluntary, and you can opt out at any time. There are some organizations that are opposed to surrogacy and say that women rent their wombs and children are bought and sold. That is incredibly offensive. I am not an object. The children I had as a surrogate always belong to their parents, just as yours do to you. I hope these organizations realize they are talking about real people and stop referring to us in this hurtful way. I've been a surrogate twice for the same family. I was compensated, and I deserved it. Each journey took a year and a half of my time, shots in my muscles every day, countless doctor's appointments, and not to mention being pregnant 24/7 for 9 months and then delivery. It's no walk in the park. Compensation is not the reason I became a surrogate, but it did help cover some of my time, pain, sacrifice, and the risk that I put into this. The couple I helped are wonderful people that my whole family is now close with. They tried for 15 years to have their children, and their parents are now happy grandparents. These two girls are some of the most adored, loved, and wanted children you could ever meet. I'll never forget that first moment, that giving birth in the hospital. It was like two people melted away and were replaced with the most vulnerable and loving people on the planet. I not only got to witness it, I helped them achieve it. It was one of the proudest moments of my life. So thanks for listening to my story, and I ask you to support this bill. It properly regulates and preserves this important family-building option.
Thank you very much. And then we have Stephen Snyder. All right. Welcome. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I am Stephen Snyder. I'm an attorney that's been practicing surrogacy law for 3 decades in Minnesota. I've personally interacted with over 500 surrogates. I know their personality and nature. I'm also the past chair of the American Bar Association Assisted Reproductive Technology Committee. So I've worked in multiple capacities on national legislation, both through the American Bar Association and the Uniform Law Commission. The purpose of this bill is really to bring Minnesota in line with what is happening legislatively in virtually every other state as they affirm the process of surrogacy and regulate it for the safety of the parties. The bill in front of you is in keeping with all of the national legislative trends. Representative Lesch has explained the state flood of approval of the process, and I also want to affirm that there are two national acts, the American Bar Association Model Act, which was voted on by 400 delegates from 50 states, and the Uniform Law Commission Uniform Parentage Act, which was voted on delegates from all 50 states. Each of those approved and affirmed compensated surrogacy as a reproductive option for infertile parents. The bill in front of you contains the consensus items, the things that nobody argued about when the Legislative Commission was there. There are things that are not mentioned or affirmatively or negatively referenced, but nobody disputed the things that are in the bill, the proper screening of surrogates, the proper relationship and screening of parents, the proper terms of the agreement, separate independent legal representation, all of the protections that are necessary so that we know the parties are suitable to the process and the process is safe for them. Having worked with 500 surrogates, I want you to understand surrogates are not tricked into doing this. They come and ask to do it. Out of every 20 women that apply to be a surrogate in Minnesota, only one is approved. That's how stringent the requirements are.
We're over 2 minutes.
All right.
You can wrap up your comments again.
All right. Thank you. The last thing I want to say is that surrogacy is an infertility option for those with uterine infertility. You're going to hear a bill today to equalize sperm donation and egg donation, the other types of infertility. If you approve that and legislatively mandate parentage and egg donation and sperm donation, those with uterine infertility like the Weisses will be the only people without an option. So this bill addresses that third option and needs to be in place as well.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. And that was all I had signed up for the proponents of the bill. Was there somebody else signed up as a proponent? Okay. Then we had several people signed up who are in opposition. And so could we have Terry Forletti? Welcome. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
My name is Terry Forletti. I'm the executive director for Breaking Free. We oppose this bill. I don't have a master's. I don't have all those degrees. But what I have is 30 years in the life experience with my body being rented and sold. I have a letter here that was presented to Governor Cuomo in New York 3 weeks ago, where we have civil rights, and this is primarily on behalf of CATW, which is the Coalition Against Trafficked Women. It's an international organization that looks out for surrogacy in countries all over the world, of which most of them, it is banned. And we also oppose this bill. And I just want to present 86 signatures that explain why we're in opposition to this bill. We're not talking about altruistic surrogacy. We're not talking about that at all. We're talking about the commodifying of us once again as human beings. We know that by putting this bill into place, it would risk the physical and psychological health and economic well-being of the most marginalized women of our state. I know women that have carried babies in surrogacy positions who were forced to abort their baby in the fourth trimester because of congenital anomalies. They were forced to abort that baby. You no longer have control over your body when it is commercialized. We know that disproportionately the number of people that are used in this have histories of being abused, discriminated against, and women in debt, including young women with student loans or dreams of higher education, and would incentivize and unleash a ruthless industry eager to profit from their exploitation. We know there's people out there that can't have babies. We're not about that. That's not what this is about. We need you to take a look at the moral aspect of it. We need you to take a look at those of us that get rented, whose bodies have been bought and sold, that was discussed so passively earlier today. But it's a big deal. It's a huge health risk to our community. And what kind of message are we going to send to the rest of the United States? By the way, most states are opposing this bill as well. So thank you for listening. And my friend, we're usually on the same side, because I thank you for all your work that you've done in sex trafficking. And you are a champion. And I just wish this could be written a little bit differently to protect those of us that are the most vulnerable.
Thank you, Ms. Forletti. All right, so next we have Anna Wills. All right, and then on deck is Maria Martinez. So if everybody that's scheduled here, I'll list them. Anna Wills, Maria Martinez, Meredith Campbell, and Emily Zinus. If you could come on down if you're on deck and sit in this front row so we can move you through here so we can hear from everybody. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Wills, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Family Council and also as a concerned citizen and a mother of three children, two of which are twins whom I was pregnant with when I served on the Surrogacy Commission when I was a state representative. I went into those meetings on the commission with skepticism and thinking that the best solution would be to ban surrogacy due to the many ways it can go wrong, and thinking also about the murky ethical territory. But I was determined to keep an open mind during the meetings and listen to the testimony, and ended up voting in favor of the majority report. House File 1140, I oppose because it ignores key recommendations from the majority report. One, the bill does not restrict multi-embryo transfers, which does open the door for selective reduction abortions of embryos deemed extra. Two, there's no requirement of U.S. residency for intended parents and surrogates, thus failing to protect children born of surrogacy who might not be able to receive the full protection of U.S. law or access their medical history if either party in a surrogacy arrangement is not a U.S. resident. Three, the bill does not prohibit for-profit arrangements, which would effectively create a commercial market where the financial interests of the industry are prioritized at the expense of the well-being of women and children. Four, the bill fails to require that a surrogate be financially secure and not on any form of public assistance, thus allowing unscrupulous surrogacy brokers to prey upon financially vulnerable women and families. Five, the bill fails to provide adequate protections for the surrogate, such as the bill does not require providing a list of potential risks and side effects of hormone treatments and pregnancy when carrying a non-genetically related child. Six, unlike adoption law, there's no requirement that surrogacy agencies be formed as nonprofit corporations and licensed by the Department of Human Services. So in closing, I'm not opposed to regulating surrogacy in Minnesota, but this bill fails to protect the women and children involved in surrogacy arrangements. Therefore, I'm opposed to House File 1140 and ask members of the committee to please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wills. Maria Martinez? Great, thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Maria Martinez. I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 1140 and Senate 1533. I'm originally from Mexico and currently reside in Eden Prairie. My husband and I moved to North Dakota in 1998 and were eager to start a family. For 2 years, we were unable to get pregnant and struggled with the pain of infertility. During that challenging time, surrogacy came up an option, and we ultimately decided against the use of surrogate. Throughout the decision-making process, I encountered the realities of commercial surrogacy. As I found out more about the process of using a surrogate, the more uncomfortable I became with the reality I was seeing before me. Commercial surrogacy is paying to rent a woman's womb. I know firsthand the pain and heartbreak of experiencing infertility, but I could not turn to commercial surrogacy as an option. Throughout my journey, I became convicted that children are a gift, not commodities, to be bought and sold, which is how commercial surrogacy treats both women and children. At that time, I ached to have a child, but I could not do so by exploiting and commodifying another woman. To legalize commercial surrogacy arrangement in Minnesota will be a failure to protect women and children of our state. This is why I oppose this bill and respectfully ask the committee to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Meredith Campbell, welcome. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Meredith Campbell, Policy Director for Minnesota Family Council. Today I am here on behalf of Minnesotans for Surrogacy Awareness, a coalition dedicated to encouraging our public officials to adopt common sense public policies that protect women and children. Well-meaning people, like those you heard from today and perhaps even our friends and family, have chosen surrogacy to satisfy their deep longing to become parents despite the challenges of infertility. Though we may be touched by the stories of those for whom surrogacy was an apparent success, we cannot ignore the many stories that did not have such a happy ending. In fact, surrogacy arrangements undermine the basic rights and well-being of women and children, and it's for this reason that many countries and states have either banned or strictly limited it. France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Switzerland all have laws that make commercial surrogacy illegal or the contracts void. For-profit arrangements are banned in Canada, almost all European countries, and some U.S. states. As you have heard today, commercial surrogacy is linked to human trafficking, and it has been condemned as a form of violence against women. And yet, despite these concerns, the language before you would not only enable a commercial surrogacy market in our state, it would cause the practice to flourish. Other states that have legalized commercial surrogacy have seen their state's reproductive tourism grow. There is a reasonable path forward to regulate surrogacy in Minnesota, but the legislation before you is not it. There is a bipartisan bill that has been introduced that offers more protections to all parties involved, including the resulting child. That bill recognizes the very real human trafficking concerns associated with commercial surrogacy. That bill provides for compensation to the surrogate for reasonable expenses. But this bill, the bill before you, creates a marketplace and allows the industry to prey upon socioeconomically vulnerable women to serve as surrogates. It ignores many of the Minnesota Commission recommendations supported by testimony and the practice of industry members themselves. It prioritizes the financial interests of the industry at the expense of the well-being of women and children. The bill before you is simply fraught with problems. There is another option for Minnesota and a better way forward. I encourage you to consider that bill and oppose the one before you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And then we have Emily Zinos. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But
it's Zinos.
Zinos. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Emily Zinos, and I'm a member of Hands Across the Aisle. It's a multi-partisan global coalition of women from across the political spectrum. Our organization's members come from all over the political spectrum, including members who are pro-choice and members who are pro-life. But we've chosen to stand together to fight against legislation that would allow low-income women to be treated as a subclass of mothers. For that reason, we oppose House File 1140. Commercial surrogacy was banned in Thailand, Nepal, Mexico, and India after it became obvious that the wombs of poor women were being used by wealthy buyers who had no interest in the well-being of these women post-birth. One surrogate mother in India said of her experience carrying the baby of a wealthy couple, "Why would I be a surrogate for someone else if I didn't need the money? Why would I make myself go through this pain?" Whether in the third world or right here in Minnesota, commercial surrogacy leaves poor and low-income women without protection from opportunistic surrogacy brokers who will use the need for income as an opening to lure these women into bearing the risks of a surrogate pregnancy. Taking on the dangerous task of bearing and birthing other people's babies is not a choice freely made when poverty is a factor. Further, making the assumption that commercial surrogacy atrocities only exist in the third world and would not befall poor women here in Minnesota is overtly racist. Commercial surrogacy exploits poor women in every place that it exists, and Minnesota would be no exception. Poverty breeds desperation, and commercial surrogacy makes it all too easy to treat impoverished women as breeders. Out of respect for the dignity and well-being of poor women here in Minnesota, please oppose House File 1140. Thank you.
Thank you. So that was all we had as far as testifiers signed up. And so what I think we'll do next is take questions from members. And then when we open it up to the audience for other testifiers, we'll ask you to limit your testimony to a minute. All right. Representative Lesh, would you want it to comment before we open it up for questions?
I would ask members, when I ask questions, to keep in mind, in light of some of the testimony that's been made, that this bill is not legalizing surrogacy in Minnesota. It's legal. It's here. It's happening. It's just happening with an inordinate and painful number of hurdles and burdens for families that desperately want a child. So they either go to other states, or they jump through the legal hurdles, or they employ the services of attorneys like Mr. Snyder, who is doing it because he believes in the right of these families to have children. I went up to a couple courthouses with him on some of these just to see it a few years ago when the Surrogacy Commission was debating this. He is genuinely and absolutely interested in the long time happiness of the surrogate as well as the family. He's not doing this for the money. I've seen his car. He doesn't drive a very nice car. So I'd ask you to keep in mind that perspective of where we're at right now, which is the Wild West of anything goes. So folks who have concerns about the exploitation of women, if that's what they're concerned about, then that's what should be happening now. But I've not heard stories about that in Minnesota right now. This bill is simply providing a framework. I understand it does not contain additional abortion language that people want, and it doesn't contain additional language prescribing limitations or caps on salary that people want. We can debate those at another time. But I think we owe it to ourselves and to the families that desperately want this to at least get this started with a regulatory framework on which they can rely. With that, I stand for questions. And I'd ask that Mr. Snyder come forward, too, because he knows this stuff inside and out. So he's going to answer some technical questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Lesh, I really appreciate you bringing this legislation forward. I really struggle with this particular issue because I'm just full disclosure. I mean, I have two children that I gave birth to, but I looked for surrogacy for myself because I came from a family of six children. My husband's from a family of five children. I always wanted a huge family, but for medical reasons, I couldn't. And so after my second child, I became really sick, and the doctor said, you know, we recommend you not have any more children. And so all I wanted was to have another child. And when I looked, it was really difficult because I didn't know who to talk to. I didn't know how it was regulated. I didn't know what organizations to go to. I didn't know all the things that I had to consider. And it became such a it was a couple of years for me just to find information that I needed. And I feel like having legislation that sort of put structure around this would be really helpful for families that are really wanting to do this and is something that's really important. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward and putting structure to this issue that already exists here and making the process so that it's easier for families like mine to navigate and as we explore options for us. You touched on this just a little bit already, but I know that I heard the testifiers talking about the exploitation of women in other countries, which I read quite a bit about also, and I guess I just wanted to understand, do we have data in Minnesota or in the United States that show that it's vulnerable women that are choosing surrogacy, and also how do organizations that support this, how do they actually recruit people to be a surrogate? I mean, that's probably not the right word to use, is recruit, but how do they identify women who want to be surrogate? Is it like the drug companies in which you have ads and then people come and you choose those people, or is it really a really one-off like process that you work through? And so those are my two questions for either you or the testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, I defer Mr. Snyder on that.
Yes, Mr. Snyder, go right ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Herr, those are excellent questions. Having interacted with over 500 surrogates, I actually took some demographic data. The average household income of a surrogate in Minnesota, surrogate and spouse, is over $100,000. Their average education level is high school plus 3.5 years of college. Surrogacy itself is not a toxic process. It is a toxic process in a toxic social environment. The opponents of surrogacy worldwide argue about India and Thailand and the Ukraine. Those ills, the picture they want to paint, exist elsewhere. They do not exist in the United States. They do not exist in Minnesota. We were here for an advocacy day yesterday, and we submitted a letter to the people that we spoke to that has almost 400 women that have been surrogates in Minnesota that say we're not being commodified, we're not being tricked. And the way that women come into the process, and there are five surrogates sitting right here, or four. How many of you Googled surrogacy? They come to us. They seek out the services of someone that can access them to the process because they decide they want to do this because of their family priority and their altruistic motivation. Nobody goes out and ropes them in. And out of every 20 that apply, only one is allowed to do it for their own safety. So the picture that they're painting of surrogates as needing protection doesn't exist here. It's just not even applicable.
Yep.
Representative Herr.
And can you tell me, do we have records in Minnesota? And sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't acknowledge before I started asking. Chair Lush, can you tell me how long surrogacy has existed in Minnesota? So, I mean, when's the first documented case we've had here and that, how long that industry has existed here?
Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, Representative Herr, I did the first surrogacy case in Minnesota in 1991.
Okay. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my wife and I have been married over 20 years, and during that time we've traveled the infertility continuum. Including in other states and internationally. So my question for the bill author is, what is the scope of the contract, the legal, in terms of all the parties involved? So Minnesota residents, if the surrogate is a non-Minnesota resident, Minnesota residents traveling internationally to have this done, what are the implications, if any, given the different variations of the parties involved?
Yes, Madam Chair,
Josh.
That's an excellent question, but if I could, and if Representative Lucero would permit me, Mr. Snyder can speak to that specifically. That's okay. Go ahead, Mr. Snyder.
Go ahead.
Limitations.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, I give you all of my empathy for your efforts. I understand, having worked for 30 years with parents in your shoes, exactly how emotional a process that is. There are many options for people who struggle with fertility. Going out of the country is one of them. It's not a great one because it's not regulated well elsewhere. They're mostly developing countries. This bill does not enhance that or support that. In terms of the scope of the surrogacy, regardless of what our legislature does, people in Minnesota are going to be surrogates and they're going to be intended parents. They'll just go elsewhere. And they won't be regulated under our values and our principles. And this bill regulates it in those ways. So intended parents are often going outside the state to hire surrogates. If we put this bill in place, we can hopefully stop that flow at the level it is. And intended parents from other states are coming here because legal processes are supportive. So the bill regulates a process that is interstate and international, but not Minnesota residents going to other countries.
All right. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make it really clear that I don't think anyone around this table wants to do away with surrogacy altogether. That is not the point of being here. We are very empathetic to people that struggle with fertility. And that was why the Surrogacy Commission took up this subject. And I think, as former Representative Wills stated, a lot of folks were kind of going, we just shouldn't do it. It's too much of a slippery slope. And after we heard testimony, we realized how important it is for families to be able to have children. And when they struggle with infertility. So that is not the reason we're here today, is to try to say that it should not, that it should be outlawed altogether. That is not it. But Representative Lesh, I'm wondering why you didn't just take up the bill that had the Surrogacy Commission's recommendations.
Well, Madam Chair and Chair Scott, I know that was your preference. You and I both know that the that Surrogacy Commission was kind of deadlocked on that. You had the votes in the commission that day. But there were more signatures on the minority report than there were on the majority report, just based on the way the votes came down. I realize that this is a moral debate. It just is, okay? And there's no way around it. And I don't think that anyone who has a moral objection to not including those provisions that you had in there, I'm not casting aspersions on anyone for that. You know, I think you have your principled stand on that, and that's okay. I would note that I think what you brought up, Chair Scott, about how everyone agrees that folks, if we have the technology available and they want to have children, they should be able to have children. I think you're right that everyone agrees with that. I'm not sure that that's the debate that we would have been having in this committee in 1991 when Mr. Snyder did the first surrogacy. I think it would have had a heck of a time, because I think the moral debate back then would have been very different based on people's assumptions. But based on where we're at today, I chose to move forward on these consensus items because I sincerely believe that we need to have the regulatory framework in place. And if we want to have the moral debate on those additional issues, I think we can have them. I just don't think we should sacrifice the regulatory framework that's necessary in the name of making sure we include those.
Chair Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, Chair Lesh, we could have the regulatory framework with the other bill. There's another bill out there that includes those. It still provides a regulatory framework. I feel like it protects women and children much better. But I also want to state that, you know, while we heard a lot of happy stories in the commission, we heard some real troubling things, too. We heard about lawsuits. Now, this wasn't in Minnesota, but this is in America, where a woman had, I think, given birth to two babies as a surrogate, and the intended parent was a single father, and she found out just shortly after giving birth that this man was abusing the children, and there was nothing she could do, nothing. And so there are protections that we, you know, that the commission struggled over that I think need to be in any bill going forward that prevents those sorts of things from happening. And as far as compensation, and Mr. Snyder just testified to the fact that the women that do this do it for altruistic reasons. They do it because they want to help other families. And so in that same breath, then I'm assuming those same women would have done this without being compensated for it. And I remember in the Surrogacy Commission, we saw ads in California where this type of bill was passed. And there are ads, literally ads running, $60,000 to be a surrogate. And maybe that's not what we have right here, but if we legalize this in this way, if we use this framework, that's what we could have here in Minnesota. And then the statement that that's not affecting people that are socioeconomically strained, if you don't think that's going to be motivation for them when it comes time, I think we're not seeing the picture clearly for what it could become. And I think the other really troubling thing about this, especially if you don't restrict this just at least to the United States, is that you lose complete control if it's an international situation. And with human trafficking and the issues that we have these days with that, I certainly don't want women carrying babies that are later to be brought up to be, for all intents and purposes, prostitutes in another country. And so, folks, I really want your careful consideration on this. And I know this will probably fall down party lines, but I want people on the other side of the aisle here to keep an open mind about this situation, because we're playing with real people's lives here. And, yes, I want people that are struggling with fertility, I want them to have a family. I was able to have a family of my own, and I can't imagine going through the infertility process. But the other bill that's out there would not restrict that from happening. But it would protect women and children. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Did you have a comment in response?
Well, Madam Chair, I would simply ask members of the committee this. Now, I don't know how many of you have gone through desiring to conceive and have a child. I have an 18-year-old, and then I have a 2.5-year-old, and we got one on the way. And I would tell you, as I got older, being a parent became much, much more important to me. And you have those scares at the beginning when you don't get pregnant the first time, start to freak out a little bit. It's a normal human inclination, and you start thinking about options and what can you do. And I want you to think about those families who go through that situation and they finally reach the point where they have to think about their past IVF and they have to think about surrogacy. And I want you to put yourself in that situation, and I want you to ask, how many of you know a person who was willing to go through 9 months of pregnancy for you for no compensation for it. I mean free, out of the goodness of their heart. Now, my wife now, her ligaments just started stretching out, you know, and she's starting to walk with her hand on her back a little bit, you know. Okay, let's just put it this way. I mean, if I was a woman, there's no way I'd be having a baby. That's the reason God made me a man, okay? I just couldn't do it. I mean, I see the look on her face, and it's not pretty. And this is, we're only just past the first trimester. It's hard to do just based on what I see. How many of you know a person who's going to do that for your family out of the goodness of their hearts, alone? And I'd ask Mr. Snyder if he can respond as well, Madam Chair.
That's fine. And if you can keep your comments brief, and before you respond to it, I just want to see, are there any folks from the audience who still wish to testify about this bill? All right. I'm seeing about three or four hands. So go ahead, Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, as to your issue about your bill, there are just provisions of the bill. The no compensation portion essentially bans surrogacy in Minnesota because, again, having interacted very intimately and personally with 500 surrogates, I know that their primary motivation is altruism, but very, very rarely would they do it without some consideration for their family, which suffers. So you can't argue that you want to have uterine infertility addressed and ban compensation because, in essence, you're saying those people will have no recourse. And again, to the surrogates that are sitting here, how many of you are motivated primarily by altruism? Raise your hand. How many would do it without compensation? Raise your hand. I think that's your answer.
Just to that point, we heard from people in the commission that testified that they weren't compensated over and above expenses. And so I think that, you know, I want you to be completely frank and open here with what we heard in that commission, because I know you were at every meeting.
Representative Scott, you're absolutely right, but those were relatives or sisters or close friends that out of a sense of family connection did it. They weren't strangers.
Okay, so let's see. I have on the list still Representative Robbins and Considine, so we'll get questions from you, and then we'll have the other testifiers come on down. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. So I just have a couple questions of Representative Lesh. In the bill, it says that donor means an individual who is not the intended parent and contributes the gametes for purpose of the procedure. Could the surrogate gestational carrier also be the donor?
If I could, Madam Chair, thank you. I'd appreciate it if Mr. Snyder could answer that question.
Mr. Snyder.
The answer is the bill requires the intended parents to provide the gametes, so the surrogate could not provide the egg.
Okay, but where it says the gestational carrier arrangement, it says that the parents have to procure or provide, so could they make an arrangement with the carrier to also be the donor?
That is not the intent of that provision. The intent is that they would obtain it from an egg donor bank or a sperm donor bank. So if that language is enforced as intended, the answer to your question is no. This does not deal with traditional surrogacy, which is where she provides her own egg. It is only gestational surrogacy where she does not.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that was clarified. Thank you. And then I'm new to this issue, so I just wondered, current non-family members who are serving as surrogates, are they compensated, and what is the sort of the rate of compensation without these regulations right now?
Mr. Snyder.
The average compensation for a surrogate in Minnesota is between $25,000 to $35,000.
And that's just market-driven? Like there's no
exactly
regulation on it at the moment? And so,
Representative Robbins and Mr. Snyder,
I'm
just asked that
I'm
you
so sorry. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Intentional, right. But okay. Go ahead,
right.
Mr. Snyder.
All right. So understand, surrogacy in the United States is a prohibitively expensive process that people borrow against inheritances for, mortgage their houses, sell their second car. The market sets the amount. Intended parents are only willing and able to pay so much. It's like all other free market enterprises. And right now, there's a very appropriate and natural balance between reasonable consideration to surrogates for their risk and the ability to pay by intended parents, and that's falling out at about $25,000 to $35,000.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just last question. So I did look up online some of the other states, and I saw ads just sitting here on the committee for $50,000, $60,000 in other states. So would this bill then in somehow drive additional compensation? And what mechanism would create that? Because other states that have this law seem to have much higher rates of compensation.
Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, the answer is no. As the ABA chair, I'm familiar with the condition and circumstances in every state. This bill would not change the economic climate or the compensation in Minnesota. Those ads are in California. There are 100 agencies in California because it was the first state to affirm the intent test. The agencies are bidding against each other to get surrogates in a densely populated but limited populated state. So those ads are unique to California and do not only exist in Minnesota, but they don't exist in other states. And they won't, because nobody else will have that many agencies competing with each other for surrogates.
Representative Robbins, last
I'm
question.
I'm sorry, last one, I promise. Okay. So you don't envision that this law would then invite new entrants into the market that would start bidding it up?
Surrogacy is currently legal in Minnesota. In fact, under the existing statutes, other than the fact that it's not regulated, it's very easy to do legally. So it's not going to change the environment. It's not going to enhance it or detract from it. It is going to regulate it so that the rare circumstances that Representative Scott referenced and the bad stories are in unregulated places. They're rare, but this bill would eliminate even those.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. And Representative Constein. Chair Constein.
Thank you, Chair. Question is for Chairman Lesh. Your bill then is in line with what was called the minority report from the task force, but had the majority of participants signing on. Is that correct?
Chair Lesh.
Madam Chair and Chair Constein, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so I know, Representative Johnson, you had a question, and we did have several people who wanted to testify from the audience. We are going to limit your testimony to 1 minute each. If you are interested in testifying, please come down and sit in the front row. And while you're all coming down, Representative Johnson, if you want to go ahead and ask your question.
Chair, Madam Chair, Chair Lesh, I've been going through this bill, looking at the information I have in front of me, hearing that it's $30,000 to on average for a surrogacy. It hurts my heart. You didn't listen to the majority of the commission. Listen to the minority. You have issues in here and talking about this. Is this something that we needs to be looked at? Absolutely. We found some issues with the when they had that commission put together, and former Representative Wills brought that up. But the majority of the members on that committee voted for the majority report. They might have had an issue here or there that they might have signed the minority report on, but the majority of them voted for that. And I'm very disappointed that all those things from that report are not in this bill. Now, getting back to the $30,000 on average, an actual adoption of a healthy boy or healthy child is $40,000 or more. And most of them are now coming from across the other countries, which cost even more and takes years to do. We have a lot of things we need to look at. This is one of them. It was brought up to show me a mother who gave up a child and did this for nothing. Mine. When she gave me up for adoption. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, so seeing that we have some other people who want to testify, if we just kind of can go down the row, come on forward and then introduce yourself. We are going to time your testimony, so sorry about that. You can talk fast. It's all right. So introduce yourself, and you can begin.
I am Ruthie Dixon. I did talk to a couple of you yesterday, I know, and I am a three-time surrogate, and I am one of many of hundreds and possibly thousands of women in Minnesota that have done surrogacy. I did it because of my own experience with the miscarriage and how it devastated me, and I didn't want anybody else to feel that way. I now work three jobs. I have a master's degree in HR management. I am the one now working professionally to screen surrogates and to educate them on the process. I feel wholeheartedly that this state needs regulation. It's going to be done anyway. I've done it without an agency, without a lawyer, without a psychologist. I learned from that, and I use it every day in my life to make sure that we make change and that we do it differently, and I couldn't just sit there and not put another face to this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Come on forward, please. State your name and begin.
Hello. My name is Tiara Nelson. I am a previous surrogate and mother of twin girls. During my twin pregnancy, I was lucky enough to get pregnant with my best friend at the same time. And at our 12-week ultrasound, me and my significant other found out we were expecting twins, doubly blessed, overjoyed. And I connected with my best friend, asked her how her ultrasound went, and she told me that she experienced a miscarriage and she would be losing her baby. So after giving birth to my twin girls, I decided I would wholeheartedly look into surrogacy because I never wanted anyone to experience what my best friend went through, holding her hand while she was experiencing her miscarriage. I went on to have deliver my surrogate baby in November. And I want every one of you here to know that I am not sex trafficked. I was not forced into doing this. That I wholeheartedly went into this with altruistic reasons, and that I was compensated for my time, but that the compensation was only to cover my pain throughout the pregnancy, time off of work, time away from my children, and the sacrifices that me and my family made to help another family have a child. So, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Up next. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jason Adkins. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. Just wanted to clear a few points for you today about the legal status of surrogacy. Surrogacy is a global business. Minnesota cannot become truly a part of the global surrogacy business unless this is a place where surrogacy contracts will be enforced by courts. Right now, court judges have no duty to enforce surrogacy contracts, which is why we're hearing from family lawyers and brokers and others that we need to create this framework. If surrogacy were already legal and it was just fine and there were no abuses, why is the industry coming asking you to create a regulatory framework? What industry says, regulate us, regulate us? It's part of ensuring that those contracts are enforced by courts. One of the reasons that surrogates are so screened is because they want to make sure that at the end of the surrogacy process, the surrogate doesn't back out. So the surrogate has to be screened rigorously, as Mr. Snyder said, precisely because there's a better assurance that at the end of the surrogacy process, the woman will decide to give up the baby. The woman has to be ideologically committed to surrogacy. So the reason behind this bill to create a regulatory framework is so that the surrogacy industry can grow in Minnesota and can indeed become part of the global surrogacy industry. So I just wanted to clarify that point. There's right now, it operates in an extra legal environment.
Over a minute now.
Thank you.
Okay, yep. Thank you very much. All right, so can we have any final comments, and then I understand we have to amend our initial motion.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Surrogacy in Minnesota will continue whether this bill becomes law or not. And if it doesn't pass, surrogacy will just continue in an unregulated Wild West state, which is not good for anyone, the children, the intended parents, or the surrogates. The bill provides reasonable common sense guidelines that will protect all those involved in Minnesota. And I would ask you to note that no one who testified in objection to this bill or spoke to it on the committee raised any objections to what is actually in this bill. Nobody. They simply want more than what this bill provides, which I understand, but I'd just like that noted. That's it, Madam Chair. I ask for your support.
Did you have an...
I did, but I mean, I want to give the bill author the last word, so I guess I'll just save it for the floor if it gets there, but...
Thank you, Chair Scott. Sorry I missed that beforehand. And then we do need to amend the motion in order to recommend that this be sent to the Ways and Means Committee.
That would be my amended motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. So I move that House File 1140 be recommended to be sent to the Ways and Means Committee. I move that House File 1140 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 1140 will be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
They had difficulty getting back. I've been giving them a hard time.
Is it probably news or just that?
No, just old. And
oh, wait, you guys talked to 7-11-30?
Mind you, you're close to my grandmother.
How old is your grandmother?
13.
But my daughter,
my
gosh,
she figured out what it is.
Okay. Representative Brand? Is Representative Brand? Yeah, there you are. Come on up, take the seat, and we'll figure out what we're doing by when you get situated there.
Okay, so. Okay. Well,
Are we continuing?
Yeah, no, that's true. I don't know. I still don't know what it does, but okay. Representative Brand, you have 2379, a human services bill. Is there a motion that House File 2379 be re-referred to HHS policy? Representative
so moved.
Moves. Oh, Chair Considine moves that. And it's my understanding, Representative Liebling, that Human Services would like another bite at the apple on that last amendment that we summarily dispatched with all due haste. Is that accurate? Go ahead, Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I was in the Legislative Audit Commission hearing this morning, which got called rather suddenly, and my presence was really requested there. So this is an attempt to avoid sending you the entire 600-page governor's budget bill, which I'm the author of, by taking out what we believe is a provision that needs to be heard in this committee to get a hearing here, and that is the intention of this little one-page amendment.
I get it.
And so because there's no germaneness rule in committee, we were just hoping that we could get a hearing here on the amendment. The department is here to speak to this amendment, and then having had a hearing here, I believe that would be sufficient as a hearing for okay.
I would say my preference is to hear an amendment rather than the entire omnibus bill in this committee. I'll tell you that right now. But why don't you say what the amendment does, because I still don't get that.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, I was hoping that we could have the department do that,
okay,
because to tell you the truth, yep. I'm not
okay,
in the weeds on all this.
To the amendment.
I'm sorry.
Where's the department?
I am that's not my part, but I'll let Ms. Kringle.
Oh, we got eel pout.
And, Mr. Chair, just to be clear for members, this is the A4 amendment, and it was drafted to House File 1050.
Okay, I will tell you, I'm going to entertain it and allow it to be taken up as an amendment to this bill, but I still want to hear what you guys want to do. What does this do?
Certainly. Britt Kringle, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm, again, with the Benefit Recovery Section at the Department of Human Services. We essentially find other payers that should be paying medical assistance as a payer of last resort. In order to do that, federal regulations require that we conduct data matches with the Labor Department and Department of Public Safety in order to identify accidents or injuries where a work comp or auto insurance should be paying the medical bills. To that end, we are attempting to pursue a data match with the Department of Public Safety.
Okay, can you hold up a second? What is a data match?
Accident data from the Department of Public Safety would be sent to the Department of Human Services through a secure transfer of information. It would be matched against our Medicaid recipient data file, and any matches would escalate to, you know, our Benefit Recovery Department, where we would pursue identifying another payer of medical benefits.
Okay, but how does Department of Public Safety get accident data? That's in local police reports. What data percolates into public safety files?
It's with the it's from the police reports, is my understanding.
Can you speak to this, Chair Johnson?
Chair Lesh, whenever there's a accident with the injuries, a state accident report has to be filed, and it's at, in the state database.
Okay, thank you. All right, go ahead.
So this data match has been executed in the past, but the information was not reliable without having additional identifying information in the form of Social Security information to connect DPS's information with DHS's information. And so we are requesting that we receive an exception in this chapter in order to have the last 4 digits of the Social Security numbers come with the accident data from the Department of Public Safety.
Okay, so that'll be the match, the last 4 numbers,
correct,
Ms. Kringle? But, of course, more than one person in Minnesota has the last 4. So what?
Correct, but it would be with dates of birth and
with the other
names.
The other,
yes, you know, the police are filling out these accident reports, and there's often
understood. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, in a state accident report, no Social Security number is listed.
Okay,
just the driver's license number.
Okay, did you know that, Ms. Kringle?
I know that the officers don't collect Social Security information, but I'm assuming that's aggregated in some other database with the driver's license database.
Okay. Here's what I'll tell you, members. Chair Liebling, what are they telling you that we actually need to hear? Do we need to, for this to pass deadline and be a part of your omnibus, do we actually need to pass the amendment of this committee, or do we just need to hear it? Because it sounds to me like we just heard it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I was assuming that we had to actually pass it.
Is the language of the rules an affirmative action? Could you speak to that, Ms. Mullen? Do you know that? What do we actually need to do?
Chair and members, I'm not sure, but I believe in the past you have had informational hearings on bills, but I can't say for sure.
Well, I guess to be on the safe side, I'm inclined to have us vote on it and be in the affirmative, but Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out a potential technical amendment, and that would be on line 1.17, the third word in the sentence after the comma, the word "and" should be stricken. Then on the next line down, 1.18, administration, comma, and the words "except that" should be stricken. Just putting that out there for potential consideration.
Is research tracking that? That grammatical dealio? Okay, Mr. Hopkins?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that the reason that we have another "and except" in addition to the original "and except" is that the Social Security numbers that are provided to the Department of Revenue, the Department of Labor and Industry, earlier on in paragraph 3, that's the entire Social Security number. And in this instance, we're only, the Department of Public Safety is only providing to the Department of Human Services the last four digits of the Social Security number. So that additional and except that's underlined on 1.18 is showing that rather than talking about the entire Social Security number as we are in the earlier part of this paragraph, we're talking about the last four digits of the Social Security number in this new language. So I think that as written, that distinction is clear.
Chair Scott?
It's not to this amendment, but just a question in general.
Okay, well, are you done with your question then? Who was that? Was that Representative Lucero? Okay. All right, so that's answered. Go ahead, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so by virtue of this amendment, we're asking the Department of Public Safety now to collect the last four of a Social Security number whenever there's an accident report. I'm assuming if they're not
injured.
If what Chair Johnson said is that they're not collecting Social Security number information now, this language right here, to me, I'm not sure that it's saying, hey, Department of Public Safety, you now have to collect this information. But obviously, the Department of Social Services or Human Services can't collect it if it's, or they can't match it up if it's not being sent to them because it's not being collected by the Department.
Mr. Hopkins?
Mr. Chair and members, so the DVS has the Social Security numbers already. They get them when someone applies for a driver's license. So even though an officer in an accident report doesn't collect the Social Security number at that time, if they collect the driver's license record, then DVS can match the driver's license record to a Social Security number, so it already has that information. So no new information is being collected in this amendment. What's happening is that this is a data sharing provision. So the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Public Safety Division of Motor Vehicles is sharing information with the Department of Human Services. What they're sharing is the last four digits of Social Security numbers.
And so, Mr. Chair, thank you. And so are there other places in statute where we're sharing just the last four digits, and have we done that without having kind of the belt and suspenders that we've been putting on data sharing lately?
Mr. Hopkins?
Mr. Chair, members, so if you just look at even at the amendment here, paragraph 3, these are instances where DPS shares not just the last four digits of the Social Security number, but the entire Social Security number, with the Department of Revenue for purposes of tax administration, with the Department of Labor and Industry for purpose of workers' compensation administration and enforcement, and with the judicial branch and with the Department of Natural Resources. So this would be very similar to those current data sharing provisions, except that rather than sharing the entire Social Security number, DHS would only be receiving the last four digits of the Social Security number.
Any other questions? Otherwise, it's my intent to vote on. Oh, yes, that's right. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as Mr. Hopkins was referencing that DVS already has Social Security numbers when people apply for the driver's license, and I'm trying to rack my brain here thinking back to my own personal experience, but what happens if a person is a legal resident non-citizen who has a driver's license? Do they have a Social Security number, or do they have an A number, and therefore it would be an A number that's in DVS and not a Social Security number, and therefore they need the last four of an A number?
Ms. Mullen.
Okay. Chair and members, a legal resident of the United States may have applied for a Social Security card, and they may have a Social Security number, but they do not necessarily have one.
Okay, so then, Mr. Chair, my question for the department would be, do you need additional language, not just the last four of a Social Security number, but potentially the last four of an A number in order to match up whatever it is you're seeking to do?
Representative Lucero, they came to us with this fix. I'm not going to give them more stuff to fix until they decide they need to fix it. You might be right, but that's their job as far as I'm concerned. But maybe they'll go back and figure it out. Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, the H1050A4 amendment would be amended. Page 1, line 1, we would strike 1050, comma, the first engrossment, and insert 2379.
Okay.
On line 2, we would delete the number 7, and we would strike the number 7 and insert the number 5.
That is the oral amendment to the amendment to House File 2379, which was previously the amendment to 1050, but it's now amendment to 2379. All in favor to that oral amendment to the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Okay, we're going to vote on the A4 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Okay, all right, you're good.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Brandt, your bill is amended.
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to share with you the bill that makes changes to directly impact the patients and staff served by direct care and treatment. Within the Department of Human Services, direct care and treatment serves Minnesotans with mental illness, chemical dependency, and developmental disabilities. Thank you for the opportunity to share this bill that will make changes that directly impact the patients and staff served by direct care and treatment. And so this year, direct care and treatment's policy proposals accomplish three objectives within this bill. First, the bill would create a 60-day voluntary return to secure treatment setting from a non-secure setting for patients from direct care and treatment, or DCT, forensic services, as well as clear authority to the medical director to require a return to the secure setting. Currently, statutory procedures do not exist for this change, and so changing the statute to model this process used in other direct care and transfer services brings clarity and consistency. I support the forensic service staff who feel such clarity is needed and provide them with the authority to do this. The bill also changes the length of time following a court-ordered provisional discharge or discharge before the order can be implemented for a client from MSOP from 15 to 30 days. This change will help ensure MSOP's clients safe and successful reentry into the larger community after a court decision. Specifically, it will allow more time to make sure things such as community notification by law enforcement and safe, stable, and appropriate housing are in place upon provisional discharge or discharge in general. Finally, the bill will amend the statute to cover the transfer of all forms of bodily fluids as a means of assault against forensic services staff. This change brings consistency in law that applies to all DHS secure treatment facilities. This amendment also demonstrates commitment to the staff safety and personal accountability for patients being treated at all DCT facilities, as well as enhancing the therapeutic treatment environment. Next, I'd like to introduce Robin Benson, Deputy General Counsel for the Department of Human Services.
Well, I think actually if we could,
yes.
Representative Brandt, if we could just have him stand for questions.
Certainly.
In case members have questions about this rather than have him go into detail, because I think based on your explanation and your excellent presentation of the bill, I think folks understand that there are questions for the author or for the general counsel.
I have an important question.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. I believe Ms. Representative Brandt is a freshman, and I believe this is his first time before this committee.
Right.
And I'm hungry this morning.
Oh, bummer.
That's a bit of a party foul, Representative Brand.
Party foul, yeah, sorry.
When did you first realize that your mistake?
Well, I apologize for that, but what I will say is if you come down to St. Peter, I will invite you down to River Rock, and we can have a cinnamon roll together. How's that sound?
Mr. Chair, I would expect those to be in front of us at our Tuesday morning hearing. We don't need to go to St. Peter. That's not the protocol around here. And so, yeah.
And Representative Brand, the GOP lead on this committee is correct. So please bring something fun to eat for us next
week. You betcha.
Okay, thank you. There being no other questions for Representatives, House File 2379 as amended. Who moved this? Chair Considine moves that House File 2379 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to HHS policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Pryor. Representative Pryor, please introduce your bill and Representative Pryor.
Yeah, I don't.
Thank you.
I got it.
Thank you. Representative Hassan moves that House File 2397 be referred to HHS policy. You have a DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author so desires. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is amended. Now you have an A190197 amendment that the chair. Well, we moved it, but it is what it is. Okay. Okay, copy the A190197 amendment. All in favor of that amendment to get the DE1 amendment in the shape the officer desires, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The DE1 amendment is amended as well. Welcome to the committee, Representative Pryor. Go ahead.
Thank you. I sincerely appreciate the committee's time in hearing this bill, and I actually will turn it over to the testifier in the interest of time.
Excellent. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. This is a portion of the Children and Family Services policy article for this year. For efficiency's sake, we took out some pages that made it very, very long. But we have here a few provisions, one of which is related to the Child Care Assistance Program, to some data transparency. This is Section 1 of the DE amendment. What this allows us to do is to share data upon request about payments made to CCAP providers to explain how much they have received in payments, if they receive more than $100,000 a year, or if there is a negative action taken against them. Right now, this data is classified as private, and we receive a significant number of data requests, so this allows us to respond to those and provide that data. Section 2 of the DE amendment is a federal conformity piece. Minnesota statute currently allows the department or other agencies, 4D agencies and provider, or excuse me, employers, to take 100% of lump sum payments for obligors who are in arrears on child support. We've been told by the consumer, or by the feds, that the Consumer Credit Protection Act prohibits this, and so we need to repeal the portion of our statute that allows this to make sure we're in compliance with federal law.
Understood. Thank you. And Ms. Sommerfeld, if I could have you just move along.
Yep. Okay, great. Number three repeals a portion of the credit reporting statute that we can't comply with right now because the credit reporting agencies do not allow us to report certain data that we've been asked to report. And the last provision allows us to transfer cases, allows the district courts to transfer tribal cases or cases to tribal court if a tribal 4D agency is managing that child support case.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Sommerfeld or the bill's author? Seeing none, then I forgot who moved this. Representative Hassan moved it. Representative Hassan moves that the House File 2397 as amended by the DE1 amendment, which in turn was amended by the A190197 amendment, be re-referred to HHS policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Representative Pryor, for being here. And members, that is it for today. Thank you for your efficiency. Committee is adjourned.